favorable to the new government of Uzbekistan's first, and so far only president, Ismail Karimov. Instead, regulations were introduced that determined what farmers could plant and exactly how much they could sell it for. Cotton was a valuable export, and farmers were paid a small fraction of world market prices for their crop, with the government taking the rest. Nobody would have grown cotton at the prices paid, so the government forced them. Every farmer now has to allocate 35% of his land to cotton. This caused many problems, difficulties with machinery being one. At the time of independence, about 40% of the harvest was picked by combine harvesters. After 1991, not surprisingly, given the incentives that President Karimov's regime created for farmers, they were not willing to buy these or maintain them. Recognizing the problem, Karimov came up with a solution, in fact, a cheaper option than combine harvesters: school children. The cotton bolls start to ripen and are ready to be picked in early September, at about the same time that children return to school. Karimov issued orders to local governors to send cotton delivery quotas to schools. In early September, the schools are emptied of 2.7 million children, 2006 figures. Teachers, instead of being instructors, became labor recruiters. Gulnaz, a mother of two of these children, explained what happens. At the beginning of each school year, approximately at the beginning of September, the classes in school are suspended, and instead of classes, children are sent to the cotton harvest. Nobody asks for the consent of parents. They don't have weekend holidays during the harvesting season. If a child is for any reason left at home, his teacher or class curator comes over and denounces the parents. They assign a plan to each child, from 20 to 60 kilograms per day, depending on the child's age. If the child fails to fulfill this plan, then next morning he is lambasted in front of the whole class. The harvest lasts for 2 months. Rural children lucky enough to be assigned to farms close to home can walk or are bused to work. Children farther away or from urban areas have to sleep in the sheds or storehouses with the machinery and animals. There are no toilets or kitchens. Children have to bring their own food for lunch. The main beneficiaries from all this forced labor are the political elites, led by President Karimov, the de facto king of all Uzbeki cotton. The school children are supposedly paid for their labor, but only supposedly. In 2006, when the world price of cotton was around $1.40 U.S. per kilo, the children were paid about 3 cents for their daily quota of 20 to 60 kilos. Probably 75% of the cotton harvest is now picked by children. In the spring, school is closed for compulsory hoeing, weeding, and transplanting. How did it all come to this? Uzbekistan, like the other Soviet socialist republics, was supposed to gain its independence after the collapse of the Soviet Union and develop a market economy and democracy. As in many other Soviet republics, this is not what happened, however. President Karimov, who began his political career in the Communist Party of the old Soviet Union, rising to the post of First Secretary for Uzbekistan at the opportune moment of 1989, just as the Berlin Wall was collapsing, managed to reinvent himself as a nationalist. With the crucial support of the security forces, in December 1991, he won Uzbekistan's first ever presidential election. After taking power, he cracked down on the independent political opposition. Opponents are now in prison or exile. There is no free media in Uzbekistan, and no non-governmental organizations are allowed. The apogee of the intensifying repression came in 2005, when possibly 750, maybe more, demonstrators were murdered by the police and army in Andijan. Using this command of the security forces and total control of the media, Karimov first extended his presidential term for 5 years through a referendum, and then won re-election for a new 7-year term in 2000, with 91.2% of the vote. His only opponent declared that he had voted for Karimov. In his 2007 re-election, widely regarded as fraudulent, he won 88% of the vote. Elections in Uzbekistan are similar to those that Joseph Stalin used to organize in the heyday of the Soviet Union. One in 1937 was famously covered by New York Times correspondent Harold Denny, who reproduced a translation from Pravda, the newspaper of the Communist Party, which was meant to convey the tension and excitement of Soviet elections. Midnight has struck, the 12th of December, the day of the first general, equal, and direct elections to the Supreme Soviet has ended. The result of the voting is about to be announced. The commission remains alone in its room. It is quiet, and the lamps are shining solemnly. Amid the general attentive and intense expectation, the chairman performs all the necessary formalities before counting of the ballots, checking up by list how many voters there were and how many have voted. And the result is 100%. 100%. What election, in what country, for what candidate, has given a 100% response? The main business starts now. Excitedly, the chairman inspects the seals on the boxes. Then the members of the commission inspect them. The seals are intact and are cut off. The boxes are opened. It is quiet. They sit attentively and seriously, these election inspectors and executives. Now it is time to open the envelopes. Three members of the commission take scissors. The chairman rises. The tellers have their copybooks ready. The first envelope is slit. All eyes are directed to it. The chairman takes out two slips, white for a candidate for the Soviet of the Union, and blue for a candidate for the Soviet of Nationalities, and reads loudly and distinctly, "Comrade Stalin." Instantly, the solemnity is broken. Everybody in the room jumps up and applauds joyously and stormily for the first ballot of the first general secret election under the Stalinist Constitution, a ballot with the name of the Constitution's creator. This mood would have captured the suspense surrounding the re-elections of Karamov, who appears an apt pupil of Stalin when it comes to repression and political control, and seems to organize elections that compete with those of Stalin in their surrealism. Under Karamov, Uzbekistan is a country with very extractive political and economic institutions, and it is poor. Probably one-third of the people live in poverty, and the average annual income is around $1,000. Not all the development indicators are bad. According to World Bank data, school enrollment is 100%. Well, except possibly during the cotton-picking season. Literacy is also very high, though apart from controlling all the media, the regime also bans books and censors the internet. While most people are paid only a few cents a day to pick cotton, the Karamov family and former communist cadres who reinvented themselves after 1989 as the new economic and political elites of Uzbekistan have become fabulously wealthy. The family economic interests are run by Karamov's daughter, Gulnora, who is expected to succeed her father as president. In a country so untransparent and secretive, nobody knows exactly what the Karamov family controls or how much money they earn, but the experience of the U.S. company Interspan is indicative of what has happened in the Uzbek economy in the last two decades. Cotton is not the only agricultural crop. Parts of the country are ideal for growing tea, and Interspan decided to invest. By 2005, it had taken over 30% of the local market, but then it ran into trouble. Gulnora decided that the tea industry looked economically promising. Soon, Interspan's local personnel started to be arrested, beaten up, and tortured. It became impossible to operate, and by August 2006, the company had pulled out. Its assets were taken over by the Karamov family's rapidly expanding tea interests, at the time representing 67% of the market, up from 2% a couple of years earlier. Uzbekistan, in many ways, looks like a relic from the past, a forgotten age. It is a country languishing under the absolutism of a single family and the cronies surrounding them, with an economy based on forced labor, in fact, the forced labor of children. Except that it isn't. It's part of the current mosaic of societies failing under extractive institutions, and unfortunately, it has many commonalities with other former Soviet socialist republics, ranging from Armenia and Azerbaijan to Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan, and reminds us that even in the 21st century, extractive economic and political institutions can take an unashamed, atrociously extractive form. Keeping the playing field at an angle. The 1990s were a period of reform in Egypt. Since the military coup that removed the monarchy in 1954, Egypt had been run as a quasi-socialist society in which the government played a central role in the economy. Many sectors of the economy were dominated by state-owned enterprises. Over the years, the rhetoric of socialism lapsed, markets opened, and the private sector developed. Yet these were not inclusive markets, but markets controlled by the state and by a handful of businessmen allied with the National Democratic Party, NDP, the political party founded by President Anwar Sadat in 1978. Businessmen became more and more involved with the party, and the party became more and more involved with them under the government of Hosni Mubarak. Mubarak, who became president in 1981 following Anwar Sadat's assassination, ruled with the NDP until being forced from power by popular protests and the military in February 2011, as we discussed in the preface. Major business people were appointed to key government posts in areas closely related to their economic interests. Rashid Mohammed Rashid, former president of Unilever AMET, Africa, Middle East, and Turkey, became Minister of Foreign Trade and Industry. Mohamed Zohair Wahid Garana, the owner and managing director of Garana Travel Company, one of the largest in Egypt, became Minister of Tourism. Amin Ahmed Mohamed Osman Abaza, founder of the Nile Cotton Trade Company, the largest cotton exporting company in Egypt, became Minister of Agriculture. In many sectors of the economy, businessmen persuaded the government to restrict entry through state regulation. These sectors included the media, iron and steel, the automotive industry, alcoholic beverages, and cement. Each sector was very concentrated, with high entry barriers protecting the politically connected businessmen and firms. Big businessmen close to the regime, such as Ahmed Ez, iron and steel, the Sawiris family, multimedia, beverages, and telecommunications, and Mohamed Nosseir, beverages and telecommunications, received not only protection from the state, but also government contracts and large bank loans without needing to put up collateral. Ahmed Ez was both the chairman of Ez Steel, the largest company in the country's steel industry, producing 70% of Egypt's steel, and also a high-ranking member of the NDP, the chairman of the People's Assembly Budget and Planning Committee, and a close associate of Gamal Mubarak, one of President Mubarak's sons. The economic reforms of the 1990s, promoted by international financial institutions and economists, were aimed at freeing up markets and reducing the role of the state in the economy. A key pillar of such reforms everywhere was the privatization of state-owned assets. Mexican privatization, instead of increasing competition, simply turned state-owned monopolies into privately owned monopolies, in the process, enriching politically connected businessmen such as Carlos Slim. Exactly the same thing took place in Egypt. The business people connected to the regime were able to heavily influence implementation of Egypt's privatization program, so that it favored the wealthy business elite, or the whales, as they are known locally. At the time that privatization began, the economy was dominated by 32 of these whales. One was Ahmet Zayat, at the helm of the Luxor Group. In 1996, the government decided to privatize Al Ahram Beverages, ABC, which was the monopoly maker of beer in Egypt. A bid came in from a consortium of the Egyptian Finance Company, led by real estate developer Farid Saad, along with the first venture capital company formed in Egypt in 1995. The consortium included Fuad Sultan, former Minister of Tourism, Mohamed Nosseir, and Mohamed Ragab, another elite businessman. The group was well-connected, but not well-connected enough. Its bid of 400 million Egyptian pounds was turned down as too low. Zayat was better connected. He didn't have the money to purchase ABC, so he came up with a scheme of Carlos Slim-type ingenuity. ABC shares were floated for the first time on the London Stock Exchange, and the Luxor Group acquired 74.9% of those shares at 68.5 Egyptian pounds per share. 3 months later, the shares were then split in two, and the Luxor Group was able to sell all of them at 52.5 pounds each, netting a 36% profit, with which Ziyat was able to fund the purchase of ABC for £231 million the next month. At the time, ABC was making an annual profit of around 41.3 million Egyptian pounds and had cash reserves of 93 million Egyptian pounds. It was quite a bargain. In 1999, the newly privatized ABC extended its monopoly from beer into wine by buying the privatized national wine monopoly, Giannachlis. Giannachlis was a very profitable company, nestling behind a 3,000% tariff imposed on imported wines, and it had a 70% profit margin on what it sold. In 2002, the monopoly changed hands again when Ziyad sold ABC to Heineken for 1.3 billion Egyptian pounds, a 563% profit in 5 years. Mohamed Nosseir hadn't always been on the losing side. In 1993, he purchased the privatized El Nasser Bottling Company, which had the monopoly rights to bottle and sell Coca-Cola in Egypt. Nosseir's relations with the then-minister of the public business sector, Atef Ebaid, allowed him to make the purchase with little competition. Nosseir then sold the company after 2 years for more than three times the acquisition price. Another example was the move in the late 1990s to involve the private sector in the state cinema industry. Again, political connections implied that only two families were allowed to bid for and operate the cinemas, one of whom was the Sawiris family. Egypt today is a poor nation, not as poor as most countries to the south in sub-Saharan Africa, but still one where around 40% of the population is very poor and lives on less than $2 a day. Ironically, as we saw earlier, in the 19th century, Egypt was the site of an initially successful attempt at institutional change and economic modernization under Muhammad Ali, who did generate a period of extractive economic growth before it was effectively annexed to the British Empire. From the British colonial period, a set of extractive institutions emerged and were continued by the military after 1954. There was some economic growth and investment in education, but the majority of the population had few economic opportunities, while the new elite could benefit from their connections to the government. These extractive economic institutions were again supported by extractive political institutions. President Mubarak planned to begin a political dynasty, grooming his son Gamal to replace him. His plan was cut short only by the collapse of his extractive regime in early 2011, in the face of widespread unrest and demonstrations during the so-called Arab Spring. During the period when Nasser was president, there were some inclusive aspects of economic institutions, and the state did open up the education system and provide some opportunities that the previous regime of King Farouk had not. But this was an example of an unstable combination of extractive political institutions with some inclusivity of economic institutions. The inevitable outcome, which came during Mubarak's reign, was that economic institutions became more extractive, reflecting the distribution of political power in society. In some sense, the Arab Spring was a reaction to this. This was true not just in Egypt, but also in Tunisia. 3 decades of Tunisian growth under extractive political institutions started to go into reverse as President Ben Ali and his family began to prey more and more on the economy. Why nations fail? Nations fail economically because of extractive institutions. These institutions keep poor countries poor and prevent them from embarking on a path to economic growth. This is true today in Africa, in places such as Zimbabwe and Sierra Leone, in South America, in countries such as Colombia and Argentina, in Asia, in countries such as North Korea and Uzbekistan, and in the Middle East, in nations such as Egypt. There are notable differences among these countries. Some are tropical, some are in temperate latitudes. Some were colonies of Britain, others of Japan, Spain, and Russia. They have very different histories, languages, and cultures. What they all share is extractive institutions. In all these cases, the basis of these institutions is an elite who design economic institutions in order to enrich themselves and perpetuate their power at the expense of the vast majority of people in society. The different histories and social structures of the countries lead to the differences in the nature of the elites and in the details of the extractive institutions. But the reason why these extractive institutions persist is always related to the vicious circle, and the implications of these institutions in terms of impoverishing their citizens are similar, even if their intensity differs. In Zimbabwe, for example, the elite comprise Robert Mugabe and the core of ZANU-PF, who spearheaded the anti-colonial fight in the 1970s. In North Korea, they are the clique around Kim Jong-il and the Communist Party. In Uzbekistan, it is President Islam Karimov, his family, and his reinvented Soviet Union-era cronies. These groups are obviously very different, and these differences, along with the assortment of the polities and economies they govern, mean that the specific form the extractive institutions take differs. For instance, because North Korea was created by a communist revolution, it takes as its political model the one-party rule of the Communist Party. Though Mugabe did invite the North Korean military into Zimbabwe in the 1980s to massacre his opponents in Matabeleland, such a model for extractive political institutions is not applicable in Zimbabwe. Instead, because of the way he came to power in the anti-colonial struggle, Mugabe had to cloak his rule with elections, even if for a while he managed actually to engineer a constitutionally sanctified one-party state. In contrast, Colombia has had a long history of elections, which emerged historically as a method for sharing power between the liberal and conservative parties in the wake of independence from Spain. Not only is the nature of elites different, but their numbers are. In Uzbekistan, Karimov could hijack the remnants of the Soviet state, which gave him a strong apparatus to suppress and murder alternative elites. In Colombia, the lack of authority of the central state in parts of the country has naturally led to much more fragmented elites, in fact, so much so that they sometimes murder one another. Nevertheless, despite these variegated elites and political institutions, these institutions often manage to cement and reproduce the power of the elite that created them. But sometimes the infighting they induce leads to the collapse of the state, as in Sierra Leone. Just as different histories and structures mean that the identity of elites and the details of extractive political institutions differ, so do the details of the extractive economic institutions that the elite set up. In North Korea, the tools of extraction were again inherited from the communist toolkit, the abolition of private property, state-run farms, and industry. In Egypt, the situation was quite similar under the avowedly socialist military regime created by Colonel Nasser after 1952. Nasser sided with the Soviet Union in the Cold War, expropriating foreign investments, such as the British-owned Suez Canal, and taking into public ownership much of the economy. However, the situation in Egypt in the 1950s and 60s was very different from that in North Korea in the 1940s. It was much easier for the North Koreans to create a more radically communist-style economy, since they could expropriate former Japanese assets and build on the economic model of the Chinese Revolution. In contrast, the Egyptian Revolution was more a coup by a group of military officers. When Egypt changed sides in the Cold War and became pro-Western, it was therefore relatively easy, as well as expedient, for the Egyptian military to change from central command to crony capitalism as a method of extraction. Even so, the better economic performance of Egypt compared with North Korea was a consequence of the more limited extractive nature of Egyptian institutions. For one thing, lacking the stifling control of the North Korean Communist Party, the Egyptian regime had to placate its population in a way that the North Korean regime does not. For another, even crony capitalism generates some incentives for investment, at least among those favored by the regime, that are totally absent in North Korea. Though these details are all important and interesting, the more critical lessons are in the big picture, which reveals that in each of these cases, extractive political institutions have created extractive economic institutions, transferring wealth and power toward the elite. The intensity of extraction in these different countries obviously varies and has important consequences for prosperity. In Argentina, for example, the constitution and democratic elections do not work well to promote pluralism, but they do function much better than in Colombia. At least the state can claim the monopoly of violence in Argentina. Partly as a consequence, income per capita in Argentina is double that of Colombia. The political institutions of both countries do a much better job of restraining elites than those in Zimbabwe and Sierra Leone, and as a result, Zimbabwe and Sierra Leone are much poorer than Argentina and Colombia. The vicious circle also implies that even when extractive institutions lead to the collapse of the state, as in Sierra Leone and Zimbabwe, this doesn't put a conclusive end to the rule of these institutions. We have already seen that civil wars and revolutions, while they may occur during critical junctures, do not necessarily lead to institutional change. The events in Sierra Leone since the civil war ended in 2002 vividly illustrate this possibility. In 2007, in a democratic election, the old party of Shaka Stevens, the APC, returned to power. Though the man who won the presidential election, Ernest Bai Koroma, had no association with the old APC governments, many of his cabinet did. Two of Stevens's sons, Bokari and Jengo, were even made ambassadors to the United States and Germany. In a sense, this is a more volatile version of what we saw happen in Colombia. There, the lack of state authority in many parts of the country persists over time, because it is in the interest of part of the national political elite to allow it to do so. But the core state institutions are also strong enough to prevent this disorder from turning into complete chaos. In Sierra Leone, partly because of the more extractive nature of economic institutions, and partly because of the country's history of highly extractive political institutions, the society has not only suffered economically, but has also tipped between complete disorder and some sort of order. Still, the long-run effect is the same. The state all but remains absent, and institutions are extractive. In all these cases, there has been a long history of extractive institutions since at least the 19th century. Each country is trapped in a vicious circle. In Colombia and Argentina, they are rooted in the institutions of Spanish colonial rule. Zimbabwe and Sierra Leone originated in British colonial regimes set up in the late 19th century. In Sierra Leone, in the absence of white settlers, these regimes built extensively on pre-colonial extractive structures of political power and intensified them. These structures themselves were the outcome of a long vicious circle that featured lack of political centralization and the disastrous effects of the slave trade. In Zimbabwe, there was much more of a construction of a new form of extractive institutions, because the British South Africa Company created a dual economy. Uzbekistan could take over the extractive institutions of the Soviet Union and, like Egypt, modify them into crony capitalism. The Soviet Union's extractive institutions themselves were in many ways a continuation of those of the Tsarist regime, again in a pattern predicated on the iron law of oligarchy. As these various vicious circles played out in different parts of the world over the past 250 years, world inequality emerged and persists. The solution to the economic and political failure of nations today is to transform their extractive institutions toward inclusive ones. The vicious circle means that this is not easy, but it is not impossible, and the iron law of oligarchy is not inevitable. Either some pre-existing inclusive elements in institutions, or the presence of broad coalitions leading the fight against the existing regime, or just the contingent nature of history, can break vicious circles. Just like the Civil War in Sierra Leone, the Glorious Revolution in 1688 was a struggle for power. But it was a struggle of a very different nature than the Civil War in Sierra Leone. Conceivably, some in Parliament fighting to remove James II in the wake of the Glorious Revolution imagined themselves playing the role of the new absolutist, as Oliver Cromwell did after the English Civil War. But the fact that Parliament was already powerful and made up of a broad coalition consisting of different economic interests and different points of view made the iron law of oligarchy less likely to apply in 1688. And it was helped by the fact that luck was on the side of Parliament against James II. In the next chapter, we will see other examples of countries that have managed to break the mold and transform their institutions for the better, even after a long history of extractive institutions. Chapter 14. Breaking the Mold. Three African Chiefs. On September 6, 1895, the ocean liner Tantallon Castle docked at Plymouth on the southern coast of England. Three African chiefs, Kama of the Ngwato, Bathwen of the Ngwaketse, and Sebele of the Kwena, disembarked and took the 8:10 express train to Paddington Station, London. The three chiefs had come to Britain on a mission, to save their and five other Tswana states from Cecil Rhodes. The Ngwato, Ngwaketse, and Kwena were three of the eight Tswana states comprising what was then known as Bechuanaland, which would become Botswana after independence in 1966. The tribes had been trading with Europeans for most of the 19th century. In the 1840s, the famous Scottish missionary David Livingstone had traveled extensively in Bechuanaland and converted King Secheli of the Kwena to Christianity. The first translation of the Bible into an African language was in Setswana, the language of the Swana. In 1885, Britain had declared Bechuanaland a protectorate. The Tswana were content with the arrangement, as they thought this would bring them protection from further European invasions, particularly from the Boers, with whom they had been clashing since the Great Trek in 1835, a migration of thousands of Boers into the interior to escape from British colonialism. The British, on the other hand, wanted control of the area to block both further expansions by the Boers and possible expansions by Germans, who had annexed the area of Southwest Africa corresponding to today's Namibia. The British did not think that a full-scale colonization was worthwhile. The High Commissioner Ray summarized the attitudes of the British government in 1885 clearly. "We have no interest in the country to the north of the Molope, the Bechuanaland Protectorate, except as a road to the interior. We might therefore confine ourselves for the present to preventing that part of the protectorate being occupied by either filibusters or foreign powers, doing as little in the way of administration or settlement as possible." But things changed for the Tswana in 1889, when Cecil Rhodes's British South Africa Company started expanding north out of South Africa, expropriating great swaths of land that would eventually become northern and southern Rhodesia, now Zambia and Zimbabwe. By 1895, the year of the three chiefs' visit to London, Rhodes had his eye on territories to the southwest of Rhodesia, Bechuanaland. The chiefs knew that only disaster and exploitation lay ahead for territories if they fell under the control of Rhodes. Though it was impossible for them to defeat Rhodes militarily, they were determined to fight him any way they could. They decided to opt for the lesser of two evils, greater control by the British rather than annexation by Rhodes. With the help of the London Missionary Society, they traveled to London to try to persuade Queen Victoria and Joseph Chamberlain, then colonial secretary, to take greater control of Bechuanaland and protect it from Rhodes. On September 11, 1895, they had their first meeting with Chamberlain. Sebele spoke first, then Bathwen, and finally Kama. Chamberlain declared that he would consider imposing British control to protect the tribes from Rhodes. In the meantime, the chiefs quickly embarked on a nationwide speaking tour to drum up popular support for their requests. They visited and spoke at Windsor and Reading, close to London, and Southampton on the south coast, and in Leicester and Birmingham, in Chamberlain's political support base, the Midlands. They went north to industrial Yorkshire, to Sheffield, Leeds, Halifax, and Bradford. They also went west to Bristol, and then up to Manchester and Liverpool. Meanwhile, back in South Africa, Cecil Rhodes was making preparations for what would become the disastrous Jameson Raid, an armed assault on the Boer Republic of the Transvaal, despite Chamberlain's strong objections. These events likely made Chamberlain much more sympathetic to the chief's plight than he might have been otherwise. On November 6th, they met with him again in London. The chief spoke through an interpreter. Chamberlain: "I will speak about the lands of the chiefs, and about the railway, and about the law which is to be observed in the territory of the chiefs. Now let us look at the map. we will take the land that we want for the railways and no more. Comma. I say that if Mr. Chamberlain will take the land himself, I will be content. Chamberlain. Then tell him that I will make the railway myself by the eyes of one whom I will send, and I will take only as much as I require, and will give compensation if what I take is of value. Comma. I would like to know how, i.e. where, the railway will go. Chamberlain. It shall go through his territory, but shall be fenced in, and we will take no land. Comma. I trust that you will do this work as for myself, and treat me fairly in this matter. Chamberlain. I will guard your interests. The next day, Edward Fairfield at the Colonial Office explained Chamberlain's settlement in more detail. Each of the three chiefs, Kama, Sebele, and Bathwen, shall have a country within which they shall live as hitherto under the protection of the Queen. The Queen shall appoint an officer to reside with them. The chiefs will rule their own people, much as at present. Rhodes' reaction to being outmaneuvered by the three African chiefs was predictable. He cabled to one of his employees, saying, "I do object to being beaten by three canting natives." The chiefs, in fact, had something valuable that they had protected from Rhodes and would subsequently protect from British indirect rule. By the 19th century, the Tswana states had developed a core set of political institutions. These involved both an unusual degree, by sub-Saharan African standards, of political centralization and collective decision-making procedures that can even be viewed as a nascent, primitive form of pluralism. Just as the Magna Carta enabled the participation of barons into the political decision-making process and put some restrictions on the actions of the English monarchs, the political institutions of the Tswana, in particular the Hatla, also encouraged political participation and constrained chiefs. The South African anthropologist Isaac Shapira describes how the Hatla worked as follows. All matters of tribal policy are dealt with finally before a general assembly of the adult males in the chief's hatla, council place. Such meetings are very frequently held. Among the topics discussed are tribal disputes, quarrels between the chief and his relatives, the imposition of new levies, the undertaking of new public works, the promulgation of new decrees by the chief. It is not unknown for the tribal assembly to overrule the wishes of the chief. Since anyone may speak, these meetings enable him to ascertain the feelings of the people generally, and provide the latter with an opportunity of stating their grievances. If the occasion calls for it, he and his advisers may be taken severely to task, for the people are seldom afraid to speak openly and frankly. Beyond the Hatla, the Tswana chieftaincy was not strictly hereditary, but open to any man demonstrating significant talent and ability. Anthropologist John Komaroff studied in detail the political history of another of the Tswana states, the Rolong. He showed that though in appearance the Tswana had clear rules stipulating how the chieftaincy was to be inherited, in practice these rules were interpreted to remove bad rulers and allow talented candidates to become chief. He showed that winning the chieftaincy was a matter of achievement, but was then rationalized so that the successful competitor appeared to be the rightful heir. The Tswana captured this idea with a proverb with a tinge of constitutional monarchy. Kase ke kase ka morafe. The king is king by the grace of the people. The Tswana chiefs continued in their attempts to maintain their independence from Britain and preserve their indigenous institutions after their trip to London. They conceded the construction of railways in Bechuanaland, but limited the intervention of the British in other aspects of economic and political life. They were not opposed to the construction of the railways, certainly not for the same reasons as the Austro-Hungarian and Russian monarchs blocked railways. They just realized that railways, like the rest of the policies of the British, would not bring development to Bechuanaland as long as it was under colonial control. The early experience of Ket Masire, president of independent Botswana from 1980 to 1998, explains why. Masire was an enterprising farmer in the 1950s. He developed new cultivation techniques for sorghum and found a potential customer in Vryburg Milling, a company located across the border in South Africa. He went to the railway station master at Lebatse in Bechuanaland and asked to rent two rail trucks to move his crop to Vryburg. The station master refused, Then he got a white friend to intervene. The station master reluctantly agreed, but quoted Masire 4 times the rate for whites. Masire gave up and concluded, "It was the practice of the whites, not just the laws prohibiting Africans from owning freehold land or holding trading licenses, that kept blacks from developing enterprises in Bechuanaland." All in all, the chiefs and the Tswana people had been lucky. Perhaps against all odds, they succeeded in preventing Rhodes's takeover. As Bechuanaland was still marginal for the British, the establishment of indirect rule there did not create the type of vicious circle playing out in Sierra Leone. They also avoided the kind of colonial expansion that went on in the interior of South Africa that would turn those lands into reservoirs of cheap labor for white miners or farmers. The early stages of the process of colonization are a critical juncture for most societies, a crucial period during which events that will have important long-term consequences for their economic and political development transpire. As we discussed in Chapter 9, most societies in sub-Saharan Africa, just as those in South America and South Asia, witnessed the establishment or intensification of extractive institutions during colonization. The Tswana would instead avoid both intense indirect rule and the far worse fate that would have befallen them had Rhodes succeeded in annexing their lands. This was not just blind luck, however. It was once again a result of the interplay between the existing institutions, shaped by the institutional drift of the Tswana people, and the critical juncture brought about by colonialism. The three chiefs had made their own luck by taking the initiative and traveling to London, and they were able to do this because they had an unusual degree of authority compared with other tribal leaders in sub-Saharan Africa, owing to the political centralization the Tswana tribes had achieved. And perhaps they also had an unusual degree of legitimacy because of the modicum of pluralism embedded in their tribal institutions. Another critical juncture at the end of the colonial period would be more central to the success of Botswana, enabling it to develop inclusive institutions. By the time Bechuanaland became independent in 1966 under the name Botswana, the lucky success of chiefs Sebele, Bathwen, and Khama was long in the past. In the intervening years, the British invested little in Bechuanaland. At independence, Botswana was one of the poorest countries in the world. It had a total of 12 kilometers of paved roads, 22 citizens who had graduated from university, and 100 from secondary school. To top it all off, it was almost completely surrounded by the white regimes of South Africa, Namibia, and Rhodesia, all of which were hostile to independent African countries run by blacks. It would have been on few people's list of countries most likely to succeed. Yet over the next 45 years, Botswana would become one of the fastest-growing countries in the world. Today, Botswana has the highest per capita income in sub-Saharan Africa, and is at the same level as successful East European countries such as Estonia and Hungary, and the most successful Latin American nations such as Costa Rica. How did Botswana break the mold? By quickly developing inclusive economic and political institutions after independence. Since then, it has been democratic, holds regular and competitive elections, and has never experienced civil war or military intervention. The government set up economic institutions enforcing property rights, ensuring macroeconomic stability, and encouraging the development of an inclusive market economy. But of course, the more challenging question is, how did Botswana manage to establish a stable democracy and pluralistic institutions, and choose inclusive economic institutions, while most other African countries did the opposite? To answer this, we have to understand how a critical juncture, this time the end of colonial rule, interacted with Botswana's existing institutions. In most of sub-Saharan Africa, for example, for Sierra Leone and Zimbabwe, independence was an opportunity missed, accompanied by the recreation of the same type of extractive institutions that existed during the colonial period. Early stages of independence would play out very differently in Botswana, again, largely because of the background created by Tswana historical institutions. In this, Botswana exhibited many parallels to England on the verge of the Glorious Revolution. England had achieved rapid political centralization under the Tudors, and had the Magna Carta and the tradition of parliament that could at least aspire to constrain monarchs and ensure some degree of pluralism. Botswana also had some amount of state centralization and relatively pluralistic tribal institutions that survived colonialism. England had a newly forming broad coalition, consisting of Atlantic traders, industrialists, and the commercially minded gentry that was in favor of well-enforced property rights. Botswana had its coalition in favor of secure procedure rights, the Tswana chiefs, and elites who owned the major assets in the economy, cattle. Even though land was held communally, cattle was private property in the Tswana states, and the elites were similarly in favor of well-enforced property rights. All this, of course, is not denying the contingent path of history. Things would have turned out very differently in England if parliamentary leaders and the new monarch had attempted to use the Glorious Revolution to usurp power. Similarly, things could have turned out very differently in Botswana, especially if it hadn't been so fortunate as to have leaders such as Soretse Khama, Oketmasiri, who decided to contest power in elections rather than subvert the electoral system, as many post-independence leaders in sub-Saharan Africa did. At independence, the Tswana emerged with a history of institutions enshrining limited chieftaincy and some degree of accountability of chiefs to the people. The Tswana were, of course, not unique in Africa for having institutions like this, but they were unique in the extent to which these institutions survived the colonial period unscathed. British rule had been all but absent. Bechuanaland was administered from Mafeking in South Africa, and it was only during the transition to independence in the 1960s that the plans for the capital of Gaborone were laid out. The capital and the new structures there were not meant to expunge the indigenous institutions, but to build on them. As Gaborone was constructed, new hotlas were planned along with it. Independence was also a relatively orderly affair. The drive for independence was led by the Botswana Democratic Party, BDP, founded in 1960 by Ket Masire and Soretse Khama. Khama was the grandson of King Khama III. His given name, Soretse, means the clay that binds together. It was to be an extraordinarily apt name. Khama was the hereditary chief of the Ngwato, and most of the Tswana chiefs and elites joined the Botswana Democratic Party. Botswana didn't have a marketing board, because the British had been so uninterested in the colony. The BDP quickly set one up in 1967, the Botswana Meat Commission. But instead of expropriating the ranchers and cattle owners, the Meat Commission played a central role in developing the cattle economy. It put up fences to control foot-and-mouth disease and promoted exports, which would both contribute to economic development and increase the support for inclusive economic institutions. Though the early growth in Botswana relied on meat exports, things changed dramatically when diamonds were discovered. The management of natural resources in Botswana also differed markedly from that in other African nations. During the colonial period, the Tswana chiefs had attempted to block prospecting for minerals in Bechuanaland because they knew that if Europeans discovered precious metals or stones, their autonomy would be over. The first big diamond discovery was under Ngwato land, Soretse Khama's traditional homeland. Before the discovery was announced, Khama instigated a change in the law so that all subsoil mineral rights were vested in the nation, not the tribe. This ensured that diamond wealth would not create great inequities in Botswana. It also gave further impetus to the process of state centralization, as diamond revenues could now be used for building a state bureaucracy and infrastructure, and for investing in education. In Sierra Leone and many other sub-Saharan African nations, diamonds fueled conflict between different groups and helped to sustain civil wars, earning the label blood diamonds for the carnage brought about by the wars fought over their control. In Botswana, diamond revenues were managed for the good of the nation. The change in subsoil mineral rights was not the only policy of state building that Soretse Khama's government implemented. Ultimately, the Chieftaincy Act of 1965, passed by the Legislative Assembly prior to independence, and the Chieftaincy Amendment Act of 1970, would continue the process of political centralization, enshrining the power of the state and the elected president by removing from chiefs the right to allocate land and enabling the president to remove a chief from office if necessary. Another facet of political centralization was the effort to unify the country further, for example, with the legislation ensuring that only Setswana and English were to be taught in school. Today, Botswana looks like a homogeneous country, without the ethnic and linguistic fragmentation associated with many other African nations. But this was an outcome of the policy to have only English and a single national language, Setswana, taught in schools to minimize conflict between different tribes and groups within society. The last census to ask questions about ethnicity was the one taken in 1946, which revealed considerable heterogeneity in Botswana. In the Mgwato Reserve, for example, only 20% of the population identified themselves as pure Mgwato, though there were other Tswana tribes present. There were also many non-Tswana groups whose first language was not Setswana. This underlying heterogeneity has been modulated both by the policies of the post-independence government and by the relatively inclusive institutions of the Tswana tribes in the same way as heterogeneity in Britain, for example, between the English and the Welsh, has been modulated by the British state. The Botswanan state did the same. Since independence, the census in Botswana has never asked about ethnic heterogeneity, because in Botswana, everyone is Tswana. Botswana achieved remarkable growth rates after independence because Seretse Khama, Ket Masire, and the Botswana Democratic Party led Botswana onto a path of inclusive economic and political institutions. When the diamonds came on stream in the 1970s, they did not lead to civil war, but provided a strong fiscal base for the government, which would use the revenues to invest in public services. There was much less incentive to challenge or overthrow the government and control the state. Inclusive political institutions bred political stability and supported inclusive economic institutions. In a pattern familiar from the virtuous circle described in Chapter 11, inclusive economic institutions increased the viability and durability of inclusive political institutions. Botswana broke the mold because it was able to seize a critical juncture, post-colonial independence, and set up inclusive institutions. The Botswana Democratic Party and the traditional elites, including Khama himself, did not try to form a dictatorial regime or set up extractive institutions that might have enriched them at the expense of society. This was once again an outcome of the interplay between a critical juncture and existing institutions. As we have seen, differently from almost anywhere else in sub-Saharan Africa, Botswana already had tribal institutions that had achieved some amount of centralized authority and contained important pluralistic features. Moreover, the country had economic elites who themselves had much to gain from secure property rights. No less important, the contingent path of history worked in Botswana's favor. It was particularly lucky because Seretse Khama and Ket Masire were not Shaka Stevens and Robert Mugabe. The former worked hard and honestly to build inclusive institutions on the foundations of the Tswana's tribal institutions. All this made it more likely that Botswana would succeed in taking a path toward inclusive institutions, whereas much of the rest of sub-Saharan Africa did not even try or failed outright. The end of the Southern extraction. It was December 1, 1955. The city of Montgomery, Alabama arrest warrant lists the time that the offense occurred as 6:06 p.m. James Blake, a bus driver, was having trouble. He called the police, and officers Day and Mixon arrived on the scene. They noted in their report, "We received a call upon arrival. The bus operator said he had a colored female sitting in the white section of the bus and would not move back. We also saw her. The bus operator signed a warrant for her. Rosa Parks was charged with Chapter 6, Section 11 of the Montgomery City Code." Rosa Parks' offense was to sit in a section of the Cleveland Avenue bus reserved for whites, a crime under Alabama's Jim Crow laws. Parks was fined $10 in addition to court fees of $4. Rosa Parks wasn't just anybody. She was already the secretary of the Montgomery chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, which had long been struggling to change the institutions of the U.S. South. Her arrest triggered a mass movement, the Montgomery bus boycott, masterminded by Martin Luther King Jr. By December 3rd, King and other black leaders had organized a coordinated bus boycott, convincing all black people that they should not ride on any bus in Montgomery. The boycott was successful, and it lasted until December 20, 1956. It set in motion a process that culminated in the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that the laws that segregated buses in Alabama and Montgomery were unconstitutional. The Montgomery bus boycott was a key moment in the civil rights movement in the U.S. South. This movement was part of a series of events and changes that finally broke the mold in the South and led to a fundamental change of institutions. As we saw in Chapter 12, after the Civil War, Southern landowning elites had managed to recreate the extractive economic and political institutions that had dominated the South before the Civil War. Though the details of these institutions changed, for example, slavery was no longer possible, the negative impact on economic incentives and prosperity in the South was the same. The South was notably poorer than the rest of the United States. Starting in the 1950s, Southern institutions would begin to move the region onto a much faster growth trajectory. The type of extractive institutions ultimately eliminated in the U.S. South were different from the colonial institutions of pre-independence Botswana. The type of critical juncture that started the process of their downfall was also different, but shared several commonalities. Starting in the 1940s, those who bore the brunt of the discrimination and the extractive institutions in the South, people such as Rosa Parks, started to become much better organized in their fight against them. At the same time, the U.S. Supreme Court and the federal government finally began to intervene systematically to reform the extractive institutions in the South. Thus, a main factor creating a critical juncture for change in the South was the empowerment of black Americans there and the end of the unchallenged domination of the Southern elites. The Southern political institutions, both before the Civil War and after, had a clear economic logic, not too different from the South African apartheid regime, to secure cheap labor for the plantations. But by the 1950s, this logic became less compelling. For one, significant mass out-migration of blacks from the South was already underway, a legacy of both the Great Depression and the Second World War. In the 1940s and 50s, this reached an average of 100,000 people per year. Meanwhile, technological innovation in agriculture, though adopted only slowly, was reducing the dependence of the plantation owners on cheap labor. Most labor in the plantations was used for picking cotton. In 1950, almost all Southern cotton was still picked by hand. But the mechanization of cotton picking was reducing the demand for this type of work. By 1960, in the key states of Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi, almost half of production had become mechanized. Just as blacks became harder to trap in the South, they also became no longer indispensable for the plantation owners. There was thus less reason for elites to fight vigorously to maintain the old extractive economic institutions. This did not mean that they would accept the changes in institutions willingly, however. Instead, a protracted conflict ensued. An unusual coalition between Southern blacks and the inclusive federal institutions of the United States created a powerful force away from Southern extraction and toward equal political and civil rights for Southern blacks, which would finally remove these significant barriers to economic growth in the U.S. South. The most important impetus for change came from the civil rights movement. It was the empowerment of blacks in the South that led the way, as in Montgomery, by challenging extractive institutions around them, by demanding their rights, and by protesting and mobilizing in order to obtain them. But they weren't alone in this, because the U.S. South was not a separate country, and the Southern elites did not have free rein as did Guatemalan elites, for example. As part of the United States of America, the South was subject to the U.S. Constitution and federal legislation. The cause for fundamental reform in the South would finally receive support from the U.S. Executive, Legislature, and Supreme Court, partly because the Civil Rights Movement was able to have its voice heard outside the South, thereby mobilizing the federal government. Federal intervention to change the institutions in the South started with the decision of the Supreme Court in 1944 that primary elections where only white people could stand were unconstitutional.